This is an advertisement from BetterHelp. You'll know if you're listening to this, I like to ask questions. And I've got a question for you listening right now. How is your social battery? Full? Half full? Running on empty? Life is busy, fast, and time to recharge for many can be limited. You're not a machine and you need regular maintenance. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. I've not hidden the fact that when BetterHelp first got in touch, I reached out and tried their services, and it's something I was incredibly surprised to find out benefit me massively. I totally had the wrong idea of what it was and what it could do. It's allowed me to think about everyday life, puzzles, problems, and things that get in the way with a very different mindset, freeing up headspace for more important things. It's like cleaning out an old cupboard that sat there for so long, just another thing to do on a list of to-dos. Once it's cleared, you feel so much better. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK already, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professions with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. My listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/theUFO. That's betterhelp.com/theUFO.
This is Jim Semivan, and you are listening to That UFO Podcast.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. My name is Andy, and I am joined on today's show by author, lecturer, and researcher, and of course, one of the most respected names in the UFO topic over the last few decades. A very warm welcome back to Mr. Richard Dolan. Richard, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing great, Andy, and it's always nice to be back with you. Very glad to be here.
Well, we've left it 10 months since the last time, so a lot to catch up on, Richard. I catch up on your show very regularly. You're one of the headline speakers at this year's Contact in the Desert, running May 30th till June 3rd. We're going to get to details of that later in the show, but I want to talk first about a few different things. Like I say, when you were last on the podcast, it was June of last year, and since then, a whole lot has happened. We've had David Grush coming forward, congressional hearings, revelations about potential locations of large buried craft, Arrow's historical report volume 1, the UAP Disclosure Act all gave us some hope and then was roundly squashed before it could become enacted, rumours of whistleblowers coming forward, and that's just a flavour, Richard, of what's happened over the last almost year. If we could hit on some of these points to start, that would be great. So firstly, can I take you back to those congressional hearings last summer? And what was the immediate impact and legacy for you of those hearings from July?
Those hearings were historically very significant. In the history of the United States, Congress, and there had been a kind of quasi-hearing in the Congress relating to UFOs back in 1968. It was a one-day, I think they call it a symposium. But it wasn't really something in which members of Congress actively were asking questions. It was a situation in which a number of people just gave a kind of a presentation. It was useful. It was good. But that was it. That's really all that there ever has been. That was a one-day thing. And it dropped into the memory hole, and I think it was just forgotten. And so for more than 55 years, nothing. There had been no interest by anyone of Congress in having something like this. And then we get this explosive hearing. I think, everyone talked about Grush, and he is the most important of the three, but there was David Fravor and there was Ryan Graves, both of whom I think added some gravitas to it as well. But you've got a situation where in a live session of Congress, a man with very significant classified clearances, Grush, went on the record and said, yes, we have alien craft and we have alien bodies. He called them biologics. And not only that, he said, I know exactly where some of these are located. I could give you the exact address. I just have to do that in the proper setting. That's, where I'm not giving up classified information, because that was a definite concern. So all of that was just incredible. Like that was, it's a funny thing. Like 10 years ago, had something like that happened, or 20 years ago, I would have been inclined to think this will be an avalanche of disclosure. There's nothing that can stop this. It's out. The secret is out. It's done. And yet here we are. It's been almost a full year later now. And it's not quite, but almost as if it didn't even happen. So that's an amazing place where we are at as a society, where we've had this drip of disclosure data that has come out in various amounts since really 2017. And it has not caused that avalanche that I've wondered about. I think many people probably assumed. So yeah, where this is going to go is a really good question. It makes me wonder about further congressional hearings, which I'm very much in favor of. And it just makes me think, will they really do a lot? Like, there's talk, I don't want to keep jumping ahead here. I know you probably have an agenda, but you know, you assume there are people out there who are similar to Grush, and this is what I have been told, similar or even more explosive potentially, but certainly at that level. And that will be great if we can hear what they have to say, but will it really make a difference in the, particularly in the political climate of the world today, of the United States, an election year? Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of hope that it's going, that future revelations are going to move that needle very much. But I will say the Grush revelations last summer were very significant. I will just add, you know, the movement to get a UAP Disclosure Act through. The original iteration of that act was, I think, very well put together. I since spoke behind the scenes to some people involved in putting that together. It was done very carefully, I think, with a lot of thought and foresight. But I think it's no surprise. It wasn't a surprise to the people putting this together. And I don't think it was a surprise to me, honestly, that it got stripped of a lot of its teeth before it was actually passed last December. So, you know, what we're looking at is it's a battle. It's a national security state battle behind the scenes between two different factions. And it's just a lot more out in the open now than it used to be. But I think that is exactly what we're looking at.
You've touched on a few points I'd like to attack. The first one being what David Grush said. I tend to judge any explosive revelations or progress in the States as to how much of an impact it has on the shores of the UK, because we are much more stiff upper lip in Britain. The UFO subject doesn't touch the mainstream very, very rarely, yet this did. This made waves for a long weekend. I think it was maybe the midweek, the Wednesday, for example, the hearings happened. Mm-hmm. And then by the Thursday, Friday, it was relatively decent sized news in the UK. It was gone by the Monday. I sort of expected that though. And I wonder for you, what do the public need? Obviously, stateside, it was a lasting impact, a longer impact. And then for that to stay further afield, what do they need? Is it evidence, actual evidence, not just testimony?
You know, well, yes, that would have helped. But just to review how the news affected the American public, it's hard for those of us in the UFO community to get out of our little bubble and to see how the rest of the world reacts to some of this. And it's very easy, like, and I include myself here, it's very easy for me to get into this state of mind and thinking, okay, this is going to be a huge bombshell. It's going to change everything. And I mean, as it turns out, you know, I have friends who don't follow UFOs and family and so forth. And the news really didn't reach a lot of people, or it did in a very vague way where there just wasn't a lot of information. So I think I don't really know how much of an impact it had here on this side of the Atlantic, to be honest with you. I don't think a lot. I think a little bit. But as far as how to have a bigger impact, I mean, one would think what Grush had to say would have been enough to just, you know, shatter the illusions that many people have had about this, but it wasn't enough. I honestly think the fundamentals is that we have both sides of the Atlantic. We live in a world of very, very controlled media. Yeah, we've got internet, yes, but there's also algorithms and there's still big tech and there's legacy media, and they are in the UK and in the US, I think, utterly corrupt, if I may say. Probably beyond redemption. I just don't think there's any hope for them. And so as long as, you know, they work hand in glove with the deep state on either side of the ocean, and that is what they do. And until they actually cover this in a genuinely serious way, People just don't have the wherewithal. They don't have the initiative to study this and to get on top of it. But had Grush gone further and broken his security oaths and said, you know, I know of a massive flying saucer at this hangar, at this location, maybe it may have, I'm sure that would have made a bit of a difference. But he wasn't willing or able to do that.
I wonder, and that sort of ties into a smaller news item, but it made a splash in our UFO bubble, as you rightly say. Ross Coulthart mentioned that he had been told from a source, he never named that source, about a potential large craft that was discovered and had a building placed over it, a large buried UFO, essentially, that he knew of. Yeah. He said it was what was the word he used? Almost like a functional building. It's used on a daily basis. Yeah. It wasn't something that was just being kept hidden. So it could have been a huge office block, for all we know. I doubt it, but something like that. Is that the sort of thing you'd heard of before this? But then also I wonder, if a David Grush did give the address for something like that, Richard, what realistically is going to happen?
Yeah, so a couple of things. So I had not, before Ross talked about that, I had not heard anything like that specifically. I did talk to Ross privately about this. I really like Ross Coulthart. I think he does great work for this field, and I think he's a good guy. And I think he really is sincere. He's got integrity, and he's working hard. And I know he has very high confidence in that story, and I have confidence that he knows what he's doing. So I'm sure that's a true story. I have very little doubt. But yeah, I mean, If something like that had been given up, I think this reality is a big part of the controversy that went into the UAP Disclosure Act. I think there's a lot of speculation. I certainly think, personally, that you know this whole controversy over eminent domain that was in the UAP Act initially, this idea that the United States government could seize private property due to national security concerns or interests in the public interest from private entities. Public domain, for those who follow it, usually would refer to, like, we want to build a highway through your property. Sorry, the public interest is too high. We're gonna pay you the worth of your property, and we're going to take it, and we're going to build a road. That's eminent domain. To use eminent domain in this manner that was indicated in the Schumer amendment to the NDAA, the Disclosure Act, that I'm not aware that had been done like that before. But that was a real terror, because the fear was that whoever is in control of that craft, if it's Lockheed or Boeing or Raytheon, a lot of people think Lockheed, but whoever, that they were physically incapable of moving that craft to another location. And so that's the problem. Like, if you have the ability to move your assets to a different secret location, then fine, you could let the act pass, and you could just pretend or lie if you're able to get away with that. You can at least play dumb and say, we don't know what you're talking about. That's a dangerous game too, frankly, but that's a better option than what they were faced with, which was the inability whatsoever to move this presumably enormous craft that can't be moved easily or without a lot of attention. So yeah, it's a real problem. I suspect I don't know if it's an unsolvable problem, but it's not one that you'd want to be in charge of having to fix. That's got to be a difficult one.
Do you think at the levels of secrecy that we're talking about, the levels of secrecy that you have researched for decades, that eminent domain would really mean what it means? That a private contractor who has this material, for example, would give it up that easily? There's one thing playing dumb, like you say, but there's also just the fact they say, no, we don't have it, come and find it, and it's buried 150 feet underground in some mountain range somewhere. Yeah. That to me, it just seems too easy.
I think we're going to have to pry UFO truth out of their cold, dead fingers. That's how difficult it's going to be. There's too much for them to lose. And I think you're right. There's not going to be any genuine willingness to give up the information that they have. And that includes, that's not just the private entities, but that's definitely relevant people in the Pentagon and the intelligence community who have knowledge. I mean, we have to keep remembering that this UFO subject has been wrapped up with the Cold War and then the post-Cold War era in terms of national security right from the beginning, in terms of technology and science that whatever has been learned from that, I think we have to assume has been very highly prized and is quite valuable and potentially quite powerful in all of its implications. So part of this is to keep the secret from the American public, yes, from the world public, yes, but part of it is also to keep whatever secrets they have from Russians, from China, from wherever else that they want to keep the secrets from. So there's never going to be a voluntary willingness on any of their part to give this up. And then on top of that, I mean, just opening up all these other questions, the whole scale of secrecy at some point, I keep thinking, as brain dead as so much of the global public is, I have to think that at some point, if this secret were to come out, that we have possession of technology and bodies, someone's going to start asking, how have you kept this secret for all of these decades for so long? Like, What does that say about our institutions? Yes, our public institutions have taken many major body blows to their credibility, but this would be a very big one. For a United States president, for example, to say to the public, well, I don't want you to believe in conspiracy theories because those are bad, but, well, the UFO one, yeah, that's true, but none of the other ones. Like, that's just not a good look for them. And it's also something that will just raise many, many questions about the legitimacy and honesty and dishonesty, I should say, of these major institutions. That includes the media. That includes our political institutions. That includes the academic world. You have to wonder, where has the world of universities been for all these years when all they've done is make fun of this subject? Shows really how clueless they have been. And you have to wonder, is it just that they're clueless and just not that smart? Or is there some level of collusion that's been involved? I think the latter. So there's a lot of uncomfortable things that will come out as a result of any kind of honest UFO, UAP disclosure. How much money has gone into this? I mean, maybe this is a mundane issue compared with some of the other ones, but it's important. I can assume they'll lie as much as possible. That's all they ever do is lie. But then you have to ask, is there a secret space program? Are there underground bases? What actual kind of exotic technology are you working on? How far with anti-gravitics have you actually gone? How extensive is this extraterrestrial presence, by the way, including abductions? These are all questions that would have to come up. How much of an ongoing alien presence do you know about? Because it seems to be a pretty large-scale operation when I look around. I look at UFO reports all the time. This morning I woke up, I went through a bunch more, mostly from my USO book, but I read them all the time. I'm constantly reading UFO reports. And I can just say definitively that this phenomenon goes on in a major way every single day around the world. North America collects most of the reports. That is true. But that's only because of infrastructure. We've just got an easier to work with infrastructure for accepting UFO reports. But these are seen everywhere around the world all the time. This is a global phenomenon. What are they doing? What is prompting a global presence? Does it go beyond that? There are many, many hints that this phenomenon has things relating to space and time and the fabric of reality that would be a challenge to us. This is a can of worms that I see no motivation for the secrecy side of it to give up. The reason I believe that there has been any kind of outgrowth of any kind of movement toward openness over the past 6 years is because we've seen a faction that has developed. And, I know a number of those people. I don't I'm not part of any group or faction here, but I am taking a guess that some people want to make some money. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of money in UFO tech. And if you know how to get access to that tech and to create an intellectual property rights or what have you, you would have an interest in breaking some of that wall of secrecy so that you could get access to some of that information. And I do wonder, it's just a hunch, but I suspect that there's a lot of truth to that. So you're just dealing with factional wars within the power structure that we have. And as a result of that, some information has come out. But how much will come out fully is, and how much can? I'll say this, the people who are managing the secret still have predominant control over major media. They still have predominant control over all the legacy media and over big tech. And those institutions will, as far as I can see, they continue to do the bidding of the national security community. So it could be a long, long time before people get what we really crave, which is just genuine honesty. Even if we don't get every single answer, I think people would be happy if we felt that our governments were working with us in good faith on this matter. But that's, I don't think people have that idea. And I certainly don't have that idea. I don't think, speaking of the US government, I don't think it has ever acted in good faith on this matter. Not ever trying to be truthful ever. And I don't see that changing.
Well, I think if UFO disclosure, the movement, is a multi-pronged attack, there's a multi-pronged defence on the other side of that. And one of those points has been led by Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, who has been heading up Arrow, as many folks will know now. He has since departed Arrow, and we're still waiting on a permanent replacement coming in, or even what's going to happen with that entity itself. But I wonder, with the release of that historical report, Volume 1, certainly seeming to be a vague whitewash of much of the UFO topic as best it could be. What were your immediate thoughts on that?
Yeah, it was one of those things that if it were an actual university paper, you would have to fail it because, you know, like when you're in school and you learn math, you're always said, show your work, show your work. He didn't show any of his work. So there were a lot of blanket statements made in that report with zero supporting evidence provided for any of it. So, for example, he made a couple of blanket statements about these objects all being explainable, with enough investigation. And the only reason they have not been, some of them have not been explained, is because we just didn't have enough data at hand. But he said, you know, we are confident that these are all explainable. I'm like, well, what reports are you talking about exactly? We still don't have any specific examples of any of the cases that they have studied and debunked. Many of us would like to see what actually are these cases you're looking at. I have looked at hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands actually, of UFO, UAP reports of the 21st century alone. And so I'm curious, like, what is your methodology for explaining these all away? I'd be very interested to know. There was not any comment on the 2004 Nimitz encounter of the famed Tic Tac UFO. I would like to know what their explanation of that would be. Is that Russian technology? That'd be pretty funny. Chinese technology? That would even be funnier. In 2004, particularly, it's absurd, utterly absurd to say that. Is a U.S. black budget? Well, that would be interesting, but there's no hint of that either, frankly. And it doesn't look like it. So there's nothing like that. And then when he got into the historical justification, this was my area of knowledge. I've studied the history of the UFO subject a lot more than Sean Kirkpatrick has, I can say confidently. And so he's referring to Project Sign, Project Grudge, Project Blue Book, Blue Book Special Report Number 14, and he's referring to the Condon Report. He's referred to the Robertson Panel, of all things. All of these, a lot of people who casually follow the UFO field, they don't know what these are, but I know what those were. And, for him to say that the 1953 Robertson Panel supports his conclusion that UFOs are conventional, That is just dishonest to the extreme. Anyone who's ever looked at the history of the Robertson Panel, which was a secret CIA organized study in January 1953, and the shenanigans that went on with the Robertson Panel, which were extreme. In fact, it was due to very, very good historical analysis that showed the conclusions of that panel were drafted before the panel met. The conclusions being, we need to disable, disarm, debunk the UFO subject for the public. We'll bring in our friends in the media like Walt Disney and movie stars, and we're just going to demystify the UFO subject because this is becoming too much of a problem. Anyway, the Kirkpatrick report, and it was, I checked to see, like, was Kirkpatrick actually responsible for this report? Because his name doesn't appear on it. But yes, he was. That is what I was told definitively.
I think to your point, Richard, you said before, sorry, about the media. This, for me, report was for the media, for no one else, because they aren't going to care about the contents. They saw the conclusion being, there's nothing to this, let's move on, because that was then the headlines worldwide, wasn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's how it is with every one of these UFO reports in the past. He mentioned the Condon Committee report from the late 1960s, which was a whole other thing with tremendous controversy and a mutiny midway through the project and all of this other stuff. And when that report came out, it was a big, big, fat document, but all the media ever read was the conclusion by Edward Condon himself, which flew in the face of a lot of the evidence within the report. And he just said, the UFO subject offers nothing for science. It has no probative value, as he put it. And that's really all that the media read there as well. That was over 50 years ago. So it's an old story. I think these people know very well what they're doing. And the DOD, the Department of Defense, knows very, very well how to work the media. They are good, really, really good at that. So I think they knew darn well, we're going to put this out. We have a very compliant media, which they do. And that is exactly what happened. Yeah.
You mentioned the UFO, the conclusion there being that the UFO subject has nothing to offer science. And that takes me on nicely to, in November, the Sol Foundation, headed up by Gary Nolan and Peter Skaffish, were very complimentary, actually, Gary Nolan, of you in social media recently, just saying how much he'd expect you and how much people should be pointed towards your work. That event itself, what were your thoughts? Because that really did bring together science and academia in a very serious way to talk about UFOs, UAP, whatever you want to call them. And is that something you yourself could see yourself being a speaker at?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I communicate with those folks. And I think there's been some talk about inviting me for the next one. I certainly will consider that when it happens. I totally support the kind of thing that they're doing there. I will say, I don't think that I would agree with every presentation that was up there, and I'm not really going to try to even argue with it here, but, I think it's a good idea. I think the academic community needs to do a little bit better, when it comes to this. I think the academicians who talk about this need to get a little more nuts and boltsy about this, frankly. I think they're way too infatuated with the mystical aspects of the UFO subject, UAP subject, to a point where I think it's becoming counterproductive. I'm just going to say that. We're all entitled to our perspective, but I think that's how I feel. So I think there's a definite need to get a little more factual, a little more material, and actually to look at what is happening within the military and within actual people who are experiencing physical, actual UFO craft, which goes on a lot. I don't see a lot of that. There's still a big love affair that a lot of folks have with the so-called interdimensional elements of this and the mystical elements of it. And I'm not saying that there's nothing strange about the UFO phenomenon. There's a lot that's strange about it. And in all likelihood, there's an ability that these other beings have to manipulate what we would call our space and time reality. But that doesn't mean that they come from another dimension. I don't even know if we understand what that means. What is another dimension? Most people use these phrases without really understanding it. So, and then the other thing is, I've had a very nice conversation with Carl Neff about this, and I like him very much personally. So, but I remembered thinking he talked about this need to avoid catastrophic disclosure.
Yeah.
And I chatted with him after that a couple of months later. He's a very brilliant man. He is a very brilliant man, I have to say. And so we were trying to hash out our opinion, because my attitude is, do you actually think that anyone, the United States government, or anyone has a genuine ability to manage this process? How much control do you think you actually have? And by seeking to avoid catastrophic disclosure, are you interested in preserving what I personally consider to be an irredeemably corrupt structure of power? That is the United States Washington complex there, I think, is beyond redemption. I'm done. I just think that there is no hope for those people running the U.S. national security state. I think there's no hope. So I don't really trust them to do any kind of genuine, honest disclosure that is in the public interest. I just do not. And so my disagreement with that concept, that alleged need to avoid catastrophic disclosure, had to do with my own, as my own personal take on the U.S. government. But look, I mean, Carl is an accomplished military officer. He's a patriot. He does believe in preserving what system that does exist. And I get that. I understand that position too. So, you know, but that was, I think, the big theme out of this, that Saul Foundation conference was, I think, that concept, the need to go slowly, responsibly. Jacques Vallée had something similar to say, actually, in his lecture there. The need to go very, very slowly, very carefully with this disclosure. I mean, who are they protecting? As what I keep wondering, who's being protected here? I don't think I'm being protected. I don't think you are.
No, I understand that. And you're right when you say quite a few things you've mentioned there. So I'll speak personally here. I think in the UFO topic, what's needed more is the ability to debate and argue and have that as a reasoned debate and a reasoned argument. I'll say this honestly. I could see you being someone, not to blow smoke up your ass, to borrow an American phrase, as someone who can go to an event like the Saul Foundation and speak, and you could sit on a four-person round table and speak to a Carl Nell, a Jacques Vallée, a Gary Nolan, and a Richard Dolan, and that panel does not look out of place. There are other events where I think a lot of the speakers who maybe want to talk about beings coming from the Pleiades and that sort of stuff doesn't interest me. I think it goes far too far the other way and lacks a lot of real evidence. I think there's a real place, though, for the future of this conversation where someone like yourself can be at a Saul Foundation on a stage and have that conversation with a Carl Nell and have a reasoned back and forward discussion where, do you know what, maybe something does change in Richard Dolan's mind, but also a Carl Nell says, do you know what, actually, I take that point on board. And that's where you can go away and actually work on something, create new concepts, come together, new ideas, rather than some folks who will peddle the same ideology and same ideas for 20, 30, 40 years with nothing changing when the whole world has changed around them. Mm-hmm. And that's where generally I could see someone like yourself at that panel being able to contribute or that sort of event. And I think that's what you're saying, that you'd be more than happy to go and do.
Yeah, thank you. That's very nice of you to say. I think that absolutely has happened. As I just mentioned, I did meet with Carl after that for something else. And we really got along great. Actually, I really liked him. I think we got along quite well. And we continue to communicate. So I think we're both probably open to hearing each other's perspectives on this. And the same, you know, with Jacques Vallée. I mean, or Gary Nolan. I have high respect for both of those guys as well. But I mean, the thing is, there's this, it's a very different kind of perspective you get at SOL than what you would get at any other UFO conference for the past 20 plus years. Any other UFO conference, the attitude would always be way more activist. It would be like, we need disclosure now. And that's not necessarily realistic either. When you start getting into the deep weeds of what will disclosure, a true honest disclosure, involve and entail. Well, I mean, I wrote a book about this 14 years ago. I co-authored a book where we did try to explore just how much would a genuine honest disclosure rock our world. And even in 2010, when we published that book, I think our conclusion was this would be incredibly revolutionary. And there's no surprise why the powers that be are maintaining secrecy over this. It is a very revolutionary development thing to acknowledge. So there's a lot of implications. I admit that. I would be happy with a controlled disclosure process if I had any of the slightest bit of confidence in my government's goodwill toward doing that.
That book, Richard, is AD After Disclosure, co-authored with Bryce Zabel, very popular in the Discord chat for the podcast. The guys in there and girls are always talking about it. And that, I think, moves me on nicely to the real chunk and meaty part of the interview I want to get to. You mentioned earlier the book you're researching, and I think it ties in nicely with the SOL Foundation. Rear Admiral Timothy Gallaudet published the SOL's first white paper on USOs, that's unidentified submersible or submerged objects, underwater UFOs, essentially. This is something you have researched over 600 cases, I believe, now for your upcoming work, yeah. So let's talk USOs. And I wonder, how much do you feel this is part of the conversation that, no pun intended, has gone under the radar?
Well, yes, it's a really fortuitous coincidence, frankly, that I decided to go into this subject at a time when I wasn't really quite aware that there were some other folks who were really going into this subject. So that's good. In fact, with Admiral Tim Gallaudet, I communicate with him, and I did. He actually has an early PDF version of my book. I'm continually working that, but so he's aware of my work on this. But it's mind blowing research. I have to say, for me personally, it's been mind blowing. And for me to say that, I've been doing the UFO subject now for 30 years, 30. And it's been a while since I've researched something that really made me feel that I was almost a newbie, like starting at square one. But the USO subject was kind of like that, because I don't think I really truly appreciated just how many good cases there are. And how scattered they have been all of these years. They're just in some in this database over here, and then there's another database there, and then there's this book over here, and a couple of blog posts over here. Like, they're just not put together in any coherent way. There have been a couple of decent books on the subject over the years, none of them comprehensive, not even attempting to be comprehensive. So I thought, you know, I started doing this about 2 years ago in answering a question from a member of my website. I have a website called Richard Olin Members, and someone was asking me about a case that took place in 1945 off the coast of the Aleutian Islands between Alaska and Russia. And it's a pretty good case. I'd known a little bit about it, and I just did a little bit of a dive. And the object is believed, it's not known, but it's believed to have come out of the water and circled a U.S. Transport ship at that time during the summer of 1945. So I did a little thing on that, and that was fun. And then I thought, oh, let's take a look at a few other of these cases. And this is all in the late spring of 2022. And then I just got into more cases and more, and folks on my website liked it. And I ended up doing all of these private little presentations on all of these cases. And it just morphed into a full-on project. So I decided to to access all of the, there's whatever major databases. So there's the National UFO Reporting Center, which is very difficult to go through, but I've gone through it. I've gone through that entire, figured out how I can do searches on it and all of that. I was able to access, before it folded, before it went away, the website of the late Carl Feind, who just died a few years ago. Carl was a really great guy and an excellent researcher who focused on UFOs and their effects on water and the effects of water on UFOs. And that included a lot of USO cases, although his interest went beyond just USOs. It was anything with UFOs in water. So UFOs in rain or rainstorms or UFOs in fog or UFOs in snow. But he collected a lot of USO cases as well. And then MUFON was really gracious to me, and they gave me access to their CMS. That's their computer, their case management system. And then lots of other books. It's just a matter of hunting, finding used books, paying $60, $70 for a used book that's been out of print for 40 years, but it's like it's got a couple of cases in there I need. So I was just scrounging them up and putting them together. And so what I've done is, I've collected more than 600 now. And I will have to publish it in two volumes simultaneously. So they'll both come out at the same time. But, and I'm getting it illustrated. I've got a map. I've got a complete Google Earth map with pins with the location of every one of these cases, which I'll show that, for the book somehow. And then I'm creating a bunch of appendices as well. So with each case, I've created about 15 categories for each case, size of object, color, shape, distance of the witness to the object. And more, did the object, was it transmedium? Did it enter the water? Did it emerge from the water? What type of body of water? Was it an ocean or a river or a lake or a reservoir or whatever? So I have that, all of these factors that I've put in for each one of these cases. And I'm just about done with those categories. So, and then once that's done, I need someone who's going to, with good spreadsheet skills, is going to put that together in a spreadsheet for me so I can do some proper analysis of that. And that'll be part of the book as well. So it's exciting. I think one thing I could say is, like, of the 600 plus cases, I can't definitively say that I know that every one of those is a bona fide USO case. But I will be very confident in saying that at least three quarters probably are. I definitely think so. These are a lot of very specific testimony. And I think these are excellent cases. So you're talking about a worldwide phenomenon, every major body of water, and a shocking number of transmedium cases. They're not just below the water, in other words. They're coming out of the water. They're entering the water. They're entering and coming out, or they're coming out and then re-entering. Bizarre, really bizarre. It's fascinating. And there's several centuries worth of good ones. So I really try to be very careful. And how far back in time do I consider these cases to be legit? And I'm just going to say I have a bit of a discussion on my attitude about the early alleged cases, such as they are. There's not that many anyway. But the first really definitively one that I could say, this one I believe, did not occur until the 18th century in the year 1717, not too far from Martinique in the Caribbean. That one I believe is probably legit. And then starting in the early 19th century, a bunch of really, really solid ones that are very, very well documented, well attested. But going back earlier, I'm not saying there were none, but I don't have a lot of confidence in any of the earlier ones.
Not to spoil the content, Richard, and it's been well researched, but for example, that 1717 event, what about it? It very quickly happened, and why is it genuine for you?
That one took place. That was a French ship in the Caribbean. It was somewhere southwest of Martinique, and the captain of that ship, what the heck was his name? I'm going to search now. You're making me look for this.
No, that's all right.
It was a frigate known as La Valeur. Oh, and the captain was named the Chevalier de Ricourt. And he wrote in his ship's journal, and I have it right here. He says, at 2 in the morning, this is in March 6, 1717. So a little over 300 years ago. He said, at 2 in the morning, we were making some progress in a southeast direction. We saw something like the mast of a ship pass alongside, standing up about 2 feet above the water. And that's in his ship's journal. That's not the most solid USO case that I've ever come across, but it's not bad. Like, what I like about it is he's not trying to interpret it as a sign or as a portent from the heavens. Mm. He's very, very matter of fact. 2 in the morning, I was actually trying to find out where was the moon. Was there a full moon? It turns out there was a half moon. As far as I could tell, there was a half moon visible. So there was some visibility there and, you know, some ability to see hovering out like the mast of a ship. So I'm thinking a vertical object that was above the water that went by the ship. Now, that's not technically in the water. You couldn't say it's technically USO, but I'd say close enough.
Yeah.
It's a pretty darn good, you know, what's that thing doing out there in 1717? A much better one was from a century later by an English ship not far from Hawaii. And I will mention that one. To me, this is a great one from 1825. And we have the exact date, August 12th, 1825. They were somewhere near Hawaii. I don't have the exact coordinates, but there was a ship and on this ship was a medic named Andrew Bloxam, B-L-O-X-A-M, Bloxam. And he writes, now listen to this. This is quite amazing. 1825, about 3:30 this morning. So 3:30 a.m. So it's black, other than whatever starlight or moonlight there was. At 3:30 this morning, the middle watch on deck was astonished to find everything around them suddenly illuminated. Turning their eyes eastward, they beheld a large, round, luminous body rising up about 7 degrees, apparently from the water, to the clouds, and falling again out of sight, and a second time rising and falling. It was the color of a red-hot cannon shot and appeared about the size of the sun. It gave so great a light that a pin might be picked up on deck. So what's interesting is that you've got a situation where it happened 2 times, according to this testimony. And again, we're in 1825. No one's thinking about UFOs, obviously. Mm. It's farthest from his mind. It's, as far as they know, it's a natural occurrence. And indeed, you could ask, could this have been some kind of natural phosphorescence or natural occurrence? But I have not been able to find the slightest scientific support for any kind of naturalistic event. And I just don't know what it could be other than something artificial happening twice, giving off a great illumination. And by the way, this is something that is repeated, these orange orbs. This is a very particular subset of USO reports, are these orange orbs. They happen throughout the 20th century and they happen in the 21st century as well. People are seeing apparently the same exact type of thing. So I think it's part of the same phenomenon.
Really interesting, the descriptive language used, like you say, because the immediate thoughts now would be flying saucer, drone, secret tech. None of that was in the lexicon back then. No one on a ship is expecting anything of the sort. Like you say, bioluminescent algae, which I only know that phrase from Moana. You could see under the water, but there's someone describing it coming out the water quite clearly, going up into the sky. And I wonder, in all that research, have you decided that we should treat, or you're going to treat the USO subject differently to the UFO subject? Is there a marked difference in your research, your approach, or even to the origin of what these objects might be. That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show out on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify. Just search That UFO Podcast Premium. YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks. It wasn't it.